This is Your Legal Rights. I am Alice O'Sullivan in for Chuck Finney, who is taking a well-deserved night off. Our topic this evening is immigration and nationality laws and issues. My guests are Luis Rodriguez, who is the immediate past president of the State Bar of California Board of Trustees and a founding director of the Immigration Division of the National Board of Trial Advocacy. He is also division chief of the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. And J. Antonio Nieres, a specialist in immigration and nationality law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, and founding president of the Immigration Division of the National Board of Trial Advocacy, with law offices in Burlingame, California. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, by the San Mateo County Bar Association, which is composed of 1,200 members. It is the only bar association in the country that provides private defender services for indigent criminal defendants, and by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. Welcome, Luis and Tony.
Good evening, Alice. It's great to be here.
Good evening, Alice and Tony. It's nice to be there.
Thank you so much. So, Tony, last time you and I did this program together, it was shortly after this deferred action for childhood admission came into being.
Yes, it was about 3 years ago, Alice. 2012, I believe it was.
Okay, so it's probably time for an update. And I know there have been lawsuits and things happening. Could you bring us, you and Luis, could you please bring our listeners up to date on what's going on?
Yes, Luis, if I may, I wanted to point out that when President Obama issued an expanded version of DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Admissions, and introduced DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Citizens and Lawful Permanent Residents, towards the end of last year, lawsuits were immediately instituted. And in one of those lawsuits in federal court, the judge had enjoined the implementation of these executive actions primarily on procedural grounds, I believe, but a injunction was set in place. And the public may not understand that while the expanded versions of DACA and DAPA are held in limbo at this time, the original DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Admissions, is still effective and ongoing. So the message to people who are otherwise qualified under the program, or people who have already applied for DACA and need to apply to extend their status under DACA, they are able to do so, and that this injunction does not affect them at this time.
Luis, do you have any comment on that?
Well, you know, Tony is definitely the expert. The most important thing, like Tony mentioned, is to make sure that everybody's educated that DACA still exists. It's the expansion that was proposed that has been enjoined by the district court at this point. The other thing that I think we can expand further in the program is what you have an expert with, like Tony here, talking about an immigration law specialist. But unfortunately, many times folks, because they think they can't afford an attorney, whether they speak the language or not, turn to what is commonly known in not only the Latino community, but in many Asian communities, the notary publics, or not as we know them in California, but as they're referred to in a lot of Spanish-speaking countries as notario públicos. And the fear that that comes with being deported or being excluded many times leads people to make some desperate choices, and that's when they start going to these folks that are notarios. So if you want, we can begin the conversation there or continue it there.
I have a question. So is it that the word notarios is common to us as notary public that causes some of the confusion, or how does that confusion start?
This is one of these situations where a literal translation of the word or words does not necessarily mean that it's a substantive and correct translation. Here in California, like in many states, we have a notary public who is given a license by the state of California. And it's someone who's gone through a background check and must keep up with the requirements of the license. Now, the Spanish translation would be notario público, public notary. But in Mexico, like in many Central American countries and South American countries, a notario público is something different. It is a person of a higher degree in education than an attorney. It's unlike what we have here. So in the Spanish-speaking countries, it takes a lot more to become a notario than it does to become an attorney. So the culture in the Spanish-speaking countries is that when they want someone of the most and highest competence and respect in the community, they go to a notario público.
So it could be something like a certified specialist then.
Would that be a step higher than a certified specialist?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Tony, can you give us some insight into?
Yeah, well, Luis has a very good point. When you translate it, it just does not equate what it defines, really. I think that the idea also is that if you go to a notario público, he's authorized to practice law, which is not correct, basically. The phrase as well, practice of law, encompasses quite a bit of activities, some simple, some more complex, giving advice as far as legal status is concerned is certainly practicing law. Some view the fact that even choosing which immigration forms to fill out is practice of law, and that it may have consequences which are glossed over in the beginning. My point is that sometimes in the desire to try to regularize one stay, people will go to a notario público feeling that they're taking a very good step, when in fact, because the notario público is exercising unauthorized practice of law, it can create more problems for them later on. What you would have saved in terms of money and effort going to a attorney who is versed with the immigration laws would really be complicated by the fact that you had gone to a notario público who is not as versed with the intricacies of the immigration law.
And Luis, is there anything the state bar can do to regulate people who are not licensed to practice law, such as these notarios?
Yeah, absolutely. There are laws on the books that deal with the unauthorized practice of law. And there are, in 2013, when I was president of State Bar, we had legislation passed that outlawed the use of the term notario público by non-notary publics. So, like they used to do before, somebody could just put up their shingle and call themselves notarios. Now, it's not a criminal law, but it is a civil code violation. And I guess the vehicles by which people can go and complain about notarios are a number. There's the criminal side, which there are criminal statutes that deal with the unauthorized practice of law. And, Chuck is a prosecutor. Chuck knows very well the kind of complaints that are out there in the community. And so folks can go to whether it's the city attorney in that city who prosecutes those type of offenses, or the county district attorney who prosecutes those offenses. Now, unfortunately, as we know, in the budgetary ladder of priorities, when it comes to prosecutors, they're looking at the most serious offenses. And sometimes prosecuting fraudsters like this is, unfortunately, at the bottom of the rung. Now, it's on the criminal side. On the civil side, the state bar is set up to prosecute these and go after folks. Unfortunately, in the recent history of the state bar, there has not been an effective way of prosecuting these folks. And I have a feeling that will change in the near future. But at the present stage, those are the two vehicles by which people can go and seek some kind of redress.
But neither of them are, at this time at least, neither of those are particularly either handy to someone who is not sophisticated with regard to the immigration laws. Am I right that it would be difficult to get redress for some unauthorized practice that resulted in a bad result?
Absolutely. And, what I did when I was president is that we started an educational campaign hand-in-hand with many of the Spanish-speaking foreign consulates in the United States. And we started talking to some of the Asian consulates as well. And it was very basic, which was, when it comes to immigration issues, hire an attorney. Do not hire a notario. And the motivation behind that back then was immigration reform. And we told in those PSAs, we told folks, there is no reform yet, so you shouldn't be paying notarios for a law that doesn't exist. Mm. And if you have questions, then you go to an attorney. It was a very basic message that we needed to send, and it worked. I can tell you anecdotally, having recently met with a number of the council generals down here in Los Angeles, they told me that the number of complaints have dropped in the last year. And they credit it to the education campaign that I started when I was president.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's very good.
And Tony, to carry that a step further, to hire not only an immigration attorney who is licensed to practice, but there are benefits for hiring an immigration attorney who is a certified specialist. And can you just briefly give us a couple of ideas why that's an important step?
Well, the idea of going to a specialist is akin to deciding that your issues are specifically dealing with the field of or the area of practice that this person devoted a little bit more time and effort to, I guess, and more experience and took the effort to get himself certified. So the certification process has an examination component which the applicant has to pass. It has the experience component whereby the applicant announces that he's devoted a specific amount of time of his legal practice to this particular field. It also has a component where his peers evaluate him and vouch for his integrity and his knowledge of the subject matter. So it's akin to going to a doctor who is certified in a particular area where you have a sense that, well, if he's certified, then he should be able to be, he should be more familiar with this particular area rather than someone who is a general practitioner and delves into all sorts of areas of practice. So it's always helpful to go to a certified specialist.
Thank you. This is Your Legal Rights. I am Alice O'Sullivan in for Chuck Finney. Our topic tonight is immigration and nationality laws and issues. My guests are J. Antonio Nieres, who is a specialist in immigration and nationality law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, and founding president of the Immigration Division of the National Board of Trial Advocacy. His offices are in Burlingame, California. And Luis Rodriguez, who is the immediate past president of the State Bar of California Board of Trustees. He is a founding director of the Immigration Division of the National Board of Trial Advocacy and is division chief of the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. I want to just return for a brief moment back to this DACA or deferred action.
Yes.
We were discussing how if one qualified to begin with for this program, one is still qualified. Did I get that straight?
Yes. If one is qualified for this program and has not applied for it yet, he or she may apply for it. Despite the fact that the expanded versions of DACA and the newly introduced DAPA has been enjoined by the federal court in Texas, so while the expanded versions are and its implementation are enjoined, if you qualify under the original program, which was introduced in 2012. You may apply for it. And if you've already applied and need to renew your status as a DACA applicant, you may come in to renew it despite the fact that the expanded version has been enjoined.
So the original program, as you and I discussed 3 years ago,
yes,
that
still,
program is still good.
Yes.
Great. Luis, we were talking about expanding things, and what about services for the middle class, legal services? What's going on with that?
Well, you know, as many of you, I'm sure, know, one just stark statistic in the state of California is that 80% of all civil litigants represent themselves. Which it's a scary figure when you really think that 100% of all attorneys are representing 20% of the litigants, right?
Whoa, yes.
It's a huge, huge gap because we know in the state of California we've got over 250,000 attorneys, but yet 80% of folks go and represent themselves. And that was one of the issues that I took up as president, which was how do we make accessibility to legal services not only to low-income folks but to the middle class. You know, the low-income folks qualify for many programs, thankfully. I'm not saying that they get everything that they need, but they have a little bit more access than what we've referred to now as the working poor. And so, you know, as president, we started looking at how can we change the delivery of legal services. And the way I frame it is really access to justice. When we talk about immigration work, you know, the work that Tony's doing is critical. It deals with people's lives and the breaking up of families. And so when folks think that they can't afford an attorney, or many times the attorneys, because they're limited by their cost and whatever is associated with running a law office, have to fix their fees a certain way, you know, it creates a gap. So we started looking at different ways to address that.
And did you come up with any solutions?
We've come up with some ideas, and next month I'll be presenting our report to the State Bar Board of Trustees. And just to highlight some of the things that we looked at are what has commonly referred us to incubator programs, which are if you can think of a law office that opens up with brand new attorneys, paired up with experienced attorneys, and these folks are getting, it's almost like a collective in that clients are coming in, they're getting legal services from these brand new attorneys who otherwise don't have the opportunity to go work anywhere else other than to open up their own shop, and folks are coming in and getting a low cost legal service to them. That was one of the major ones. The other ones that we're looking at and that have been practicing in some locations are things like court navigators, and these are folks who work in the courthouse. Now they don't give legal advice, but you know, Tony earlier mentioned that sometimes when even recommending that a certain form be filled, it could be practicing law. Well, when somebody goes in front of a judge, and all of us, it happens to all of us, the attorneys especially sometimes, is, you know, we're intimidated. So you can only imagine a layperson going in there without an attorney. So the concept of a court navigator is somebody there who, you know, after everything is said by the judge, can basically repeat to the person in lay terms, all right, this is what you need to do, this is where you need to go, and this is who you need to talk to. Those are some of the concepts. And the other one was, which has been talked about for a while, which is the limited legal license, which is a step below being an attorney. So in some states, we're looking at Washington, where it just started now, where certain people are given a limited license to practice law in, let's say, family law, where they can give some minimal advice. And again, the idea is similar to the practice of medicine, where you have nurse practitioners who sometimes see the patients before they're seen by a medical doctor. The medical industry has been doing it for decades, and I think that the legal industry, we need to look at a way to expand services, or else our profession is going to become the kind of profession that's only accessible to the ones who have great financial means.
So contrast this limited legal license with the notarios.
Well, the limited legal license would be regulated by the state bar or the Supreme Court or the Department of Consumer Affairs. It would be a regulated industry. Notarios are not regulated by anybody. So what was happening before, like I said, is somebody could just put up their shingle, pay their local business license, and that was it. No regulation of the quality of work. And like Tony mentioned, some of these folks were practicing law without a license. But an LLC, they would be regulated by a body similar to the board, the State Bar of California.
So they would be supervised. There would be some recourse to a person if they failed to give what would be reasonable advice?
Yes. Well, first of all, you know, they would be limited as to what areas they could give advice in to begin with. So there would be the educational component, just like law school. They'd have to attend a program, graduate from an accredited program, get a license, and then the license would be very similar to being an attorney in that you get the education, you get the license, and then you have to keep up your educational level in order to comply with the licensing requirements. And if you fail to keep up your license requirements or you commit some kind of fraud or malpractice, then there's the disciplinary aspect.
And would a paralegal be somewhat similar to this limited legal license person?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. The California Paralegal Association is very interested in this model because they do a lot of the work that a limited license person would be doing.
Uh-huh.
And so, as we know, paralegals do tremendous work, and they would be the prime candidates for this type of service.
Well, I know that at least in the field that I'm certified in, which is workers' compensation. Paralegals just do a wonderful job. It's a volume practice, and so I think they are extremely helpful. Tony, do you find in immigration that there would be a use for this, even in a law office setting, for example?
Certainly, Alice. I think that when you discuss the role of a paralegal in a general law office, immigration practitioners also have paralegals who are also very helpful and would fit in with Luis's description of the responsibilities of someone with a limited legal license. I also suspect that this is actually going back to the idea of apprenticeship as a lawyer. In other words, before you become a lawyer, you apprentice as a paralegal or someone with a limited legal license. I don't know whether or not that's actually true, but it seems that way anyway.
Just so you know, that's a good point. In the state of California, there's two ways to be admitted into the practice of law. One is, of course, going to law school and sitting for the bar exam. The other one is there is still an existing apprenticeship program.
And I'd like to come back to that because that's dear to my heart, as you may know. This is Alice O'Sullivan in for Chuck Finney. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. My guests are Luis Rodriguez and J. Antonio Nieres. Both of them are with the National Board of Trial Advocacy. Tony has law offices in Burlingame, California. And Luis is division chief of the Los Angeles County Public Defender's Office. So I don't know if you gentlemen are aware, but I completed my studies with law office study in California.
I was aware.
Okay. And I think... it's a wonderful thing that the state of California has. It's a wonderful program for people either with limited means or people with a certain amount of discipline, and I don't think it is well publicized. So in that, I can almost contrast it with the notarios. I don't know how well published it is that California has this program, and it's absolutely wonderful because one gets one's studies really just on site, and I think it's a great program. So I just had to put that little bit of, publicity in for that program. I also want to let our listeners know that the Bar Association of San Francisco Lawyer Referral Service provides support for KALW. If you have a problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer, you can call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. And while I'm giving out telephone numbers, for you listeners who have a question on immigration, nationality, or anything that you think our guests may be able to help you with, please call our toll-free number, which is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Luis, what are you engaged in now? What activities are you excited about?
I still continue working with, of course, the Public Defender's Office. That's my day job. But I continue to do work with the Right now, with mainly the Mexican consulate down here in Los Angeles, and we're working on binational educational issues. And by that I mean there's a strong interest on behalf of the Mexican government to have American students go and study abroad in Mexico in their law schools. And similarly, there's a huge interest by Mexican attorneys to come into the United States and get their LLM. You know, a lot of it is driven, of course, by commerce. So it's an interesting field that, you know, quite frankly, I hadn't thought about before. But it also involves, of course, immigration, because some of these folks may want to stay here, and some folks from here may want to go to Mexico. So that's what I'm excited about right now, just the potential of creating a new area of practice that really hasn't been given much attention. I know there are some many LLM programs throughout the state, but this would be a particular focus in that area.
Can you define for us what an LLM program is? For
well, that's the master's in legal education, and in California, interestingly enough, it's a one-year program, and a licensed attorney can sit for that program at many of the law schools, or foreign attorneys can sit for the program. And what was not, I think what is not known to most folks, in a similar fashion as the apprenticeship program, is if a foreign attorney comes and sits for the LLM program, which is a one-year program, they can sit for the state bar exam. So, they are given an opportunity to be licensed in the state of California.
Tony, do you have anything you want to add about that?
That's what I thought. I thought that you can apply to take the state bar as a foreign attorney.
Yes.
Now, of course, it brings up the question of whether or not you can practice again, if you have residency here in California, if you have a alien resident card, whether you're a permanent resident who can practice. In other words, if the bar admits you, mm-hmm. but you don't have residency or alien residence card or certificate, can you practice law? And I think this was a issue that has gone before the courts. I don't know how it was resolved. I understand the state bar was a friend of the court in that regard as well.
Right, Tony. And now, I don't know if you remember, just a couple of years ago, that was the Sergio Garcia matter.
Right.
The young man who was born in Mexico, he was brought here by his father. His father eventually became a U.S. citizen, and he passed the bar. And one of, we don't know exactly how it happened, but somebody complained that he should not be allowed to take the bar exam because he'd broken immigration laws, and therefore that was a mark on moral character. So the state bar was supportive of the notion that he was not brought here out of his own volition. He was brought here by his parents. This was not the type of action that elevated to the point where moral character was questionable, and our position was that he should be allowed to receive a law license. Now, the interesting thing which Tony brings up is, okay, you can get a law license, but can you practice law since you are not a permanent legal resident? And he was not able to. He was not able to practice law because he didn't have the proper paperwork to be able to do so. The good news to that story is that just recently he got his permanent residence, so now he can practice law like the rest of us.
Oh, excellent. You know, it seems a little unfair after one takes the bar and passes it to not be able to go ahead and practice. It doesn't leave you with much, does it?
No.
Andrew, welcome to Your Legal Rights. You have a question of my guests? Andrew? Hello?
Yes, I can. We can hear.
Okay. I have a long-term friend who's lived here for over 20 years and worked and paid taxes, but doesn't qualify for citizenship. She's very desperate, and she found a friend that said that he would marry her. What are all the risks involved around that for her to do this?
Tony, do you want to tackle this one?
Well, generally, you don't want to do that. Obtaining permanent residence through marriage, while it is done, it is certainly not legal. The immigration laws have also tried to be very forthcoming that fraud of this nature will not be tolerated at all. The laws are also clear that if a person applies for permanent residence through marriage, which is less than 2 years old, that person will only get a conditional permanent resident status, which is a two-year residence conditioned on the parties coming back to immigration and saying, look, we're still married, that the marriage was indeed in good faith. And if they're not able to do that after 2 years of their marriage, then that conditional permanent residence can be terminated and deportation or removal proceedings can be initiated if there has been a finding of fraud and misrepresentation. Further, the person who petitioned for that alien spouse is going to be barred from ever applying for anyone else afterwards. In other words, there's a bar from him to be able to petition anyone else. In other words, if that person finds his true love and marries her and discovers that the person needs to be petitioned, he's not going to be able to petition that subsequent person any longer. It's just a bad idea altogether.
Okay. I'll tell her. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call, Andrew.
All right, bye.
So as a follow-up to that, Tony, I have a question. If someone's been here for 20 years, does that give a person any better standing with the immigration board, or how does that work?
Well, we'll need more facts to really determine what kind of options may be available. The 20 years is certainly a long time. If the person does not mind to go through the removal process, there's a way that you can ask the judge to exercise his or her discretion to allow you to stay because of the fact that you've been here 20 years. But it's not exactly it's not a very viable option, because the judge may determine that, well, even if you've been here 20 years, you're not deserving of permanent residence, and so you'll have to go. In other words, you expose yourself to the possibility of deportation, and you apply for relief from deportation saying, I've been here for 20 years and I have certain equities which should allow me to stay.
So it's very subjective, then. It's not really an objective standard?
Yeah, it's not an objective standard. That's one of the areas where the judges still have some discretion. The very limited areas where they have some discretion.
So you're at their mercy, in other words.
Correct.
Okay. Luis, do you have experience with any of these problems with the Latino community in not knowing where to turn after you've been here for a long, long time and are not here legally? I'm sure he has too. But can you give us some ideas about what people need to do and the situation people are in, so that our listeners know what the difficulties are? Luis?
You know, it's a matter of trust, and Tony, I think you'll agree, folks when it comes to immigration issues, will first go to their I guess you could call them their community elders, right?
Correct.
Who do they trust in the community? In some communities, it's their local church or priest or pastor who they rely on for advice. And they're very reluctant to seek out advice or help from what is seen as the government, right? Going to the courts, that's very intimidating. Many of them aren't aware of bar associations that have referral services. Some will go to the consulate offices and try to get advice. So, you know, it's important, I think, for attorneys to continue to have, many of us are very active in the community, but I think when it comes to immigration, to have a relationship with the various consulates to make themselves accessible as a resource to them, and in some communities to the religious community, because when somebody's looking for help, they go to the first person they trust, and the first person they trust will go to who they trust. And obviously you build trust by the relationship that you have. So, you know, that's the one thing that I always recommend to folks up and down the state is, you know, be educated, but be careful who you seek that information from.
Tony, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think those are very good points. Generally, you will go to people within your own circle. You know, your friends who've gone through a similar situation, or your family who have similar experiences. This is why the immigration field, much more than other fields of practice, I think, is generated by referrals. If you have if you did something good for one person, that person will certainly refer somebody else to you. And so it goes on. If you do something for one member of the family, that member of the family has other family members, and that will, again, go on. It goes. That's the way the referral works as far as immigration is concerned. Not so much, like Luis was saying, referral programs of the bar associations or other professional groups. It's really whom you trust, whom you're able to build trust with. I think this idea of trying to develop relationships with the consulates is a good one. Unfortunately, some consulates are less open to creating those relationships. Right. But if certain nationals go to their own consulates and ask, who can I speak to about this legal problem? If your name is on the consulate, then, and you have had an occasion to build a relationship with someone there, then certainly your name can be brought up as a referral, and that's always good as well.
True.
Robert, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, I heard this about law office study, and I wonder if you could tell us a bit more. Is that the same way Abraham Lincoln and Clarence Darrow became attorneys?
The very same. Yes, it is. I just briefly going back to that, I think it's important when people undertake a law office study that you know you need to have an attorney who's willing to spend at least 20 hours a week in giving you advice and educating you. And so you need to have a good relationship with a mentoring attorney, which in a way, Luis, I'm going to come back to your limited legal license. It's a similar way. I mean, you're pairing inexperienced attorneys with experienced attorneys. In other words, someone going to look into law office study needs to have a mentoring attorney. Secondly, you need a lot of self-discipline because you're not having somebody saying to you, you need to do a certain amount of study by this date, other than, of course, your mentoring attorney. But the purpose of the mentoring attorney is more to explain to you than to get a curriculum such as a law school has. So once again, I think it's especially for lower income people who are motivated to become attorneys, I think it's a great way, it's a great resource to have, and I'm thankful that the California State Bar has that.
And, you know, and Alice is being modest because it takes an exceptional person to have that kind of discipline and drive to go through that program and pass the bar exam, because the bar exam, as we all know, is just a grueling beast. But there are success stories. Alice is a perfect example. I can give you a couple. You know, I spoke at a swearing-in of attorneys in Riverside County, and one of the folks who was being sworn in studied law in Armenia.
Wow.
Was an attorney in Armenia, but studied under someone in Riverside and passed the bar the first time. Just recently, down in Bakersfield, Marcos Camacho was appointed as a judge. Now, Marcos Camacho did his apprenticeship program through the United Farm Workers for about, I think he went through their program for quite a few years. They have an apprenticeship program, was their general counsel, and just recently became a judge.
I'm really glad to hear that. I was going to mention that I knew the farm workers did have a program, and while it doesn't relate exactly to our topic of immigration, it certainly does touch on it, that as we have a lot of immigrants working in the fields, and the farm workers are doing a wonderful job of doing that. Thank you for bringing that up. Thank you for your question, Robert. Sarah, do you have a question for my guests?
Yes. You were talking about linking communities and how, you know, it's been a challenge trying to get these communities to trust people, maybe even outside of their elders who they go to. And a lot of industries are using ombudsmen or ombudspeople to sort of open up the conversation, to be the mediator, you know, someone in the middle who's really trying to help get things accomplished. Are they doing that in immigration?
Tony, you'd be the expert on that one.
No, I don't think so, unfortunately. I'm trying to flesh it out a little bit to try and understand how an ombudsman would work to link communities, particularly.
I suppose I would see it in a way, perhaps, let's say, someone who was, I mean, many times it's between employers and unions and things like that, and I was wondering if there was some way, even if the court system, you know, assigned people, or even at the consulates, if they had someone there who people trusted, who they could go to, and who could direct them and, you know, try to assist them and their families.
Well, you know, one of the things that I talked about earlier is one of the proposals that we'll be presenting next month at the board, which is the court navigator. And this person is not an attorney. This person is somewhat familiar with the community. That's the whole concept of it, having that person in the court system to help people walk through whatever it is that they just went through. So there is, you know, something similar to that, but not exactly on point.
Sarah, I'm wondering, you mentioned employers and and unions. So Luis and Tony, might a union representative, for example, who represents a large amount of folk who are immigrants, would that be a good contact with the consulate, someone to help their members, in other words, who are not legal aliens here? Would that be any kind of a suggestion to move this forward a bit?
I think so, definitely. That's
probably the easiest contact point in this particular situation.
And I have a follow-up question. Thank you, Sarah, very much for your question. I have a follow-up question to that. Do our immigration laws allow, I mean, supposing we get all of this trust and we get all of these people, what will that leave us with? Do our immigration laws, are they sufficient to handle the people who are working here, who want to be here? Where does that fit in the scheme of things?
What do you mean, Alice, in terms of capacity to provide legal status to people?
Yes.
That's always a problem because it's numbers, and I think that's the basic reason why there is no comprehensive immigration reform being undertaken, because of the sheer numbers. If the numbers were more manageable, then I think the idea of comprehensively changing immigration laws would be more acceptable. It's just the numbers of people that you're talking about prevent something from going forward at this time.
There are too many people? Is that what you're saying?
There are just too many people.
But, you know, on the other side, I hear that we don't have enough workers. We don't have enough workers in the agricultural industry. We don't have enough workers in the technological industry. So if we don't have enough people, and there are people waiting to be immigrate here, what's the disconnect?
Well, the disconnect there, the way I see it, is that you have people outside the United States wanting to come in. And then you have a number of people who are already in the United States who are undocumented. If you're going to introduce changes in the visa systems where there will be more people who will be allowed to come in legally, lawfully, the question becomes, what are you going to do with the people that you already have in here in the United States that are undocumented?
Right.
Are you going to use the visas that you were proposing to use to bring people in to take care of some of the people who are already here? In other words, you allocate a certain number of visas for the people who are here already versus just directing those visas for people who are outside wanting to come in. It's a balance of some sort. Unfortunately, the balance is skewed because of the number of people who are here in undocumented status. This was the same problem with legalization previously in the history of immigration laws, where the government thought, hey, let's allocate a certain number let's provide this legalization program where this number of people can be legalized. But the thinking was wrong because you don't legalize one person. That one person has a spouse,
mm-hmm.
and they have children.
Right.
And so instead of allocating just one, you can't. The numbers exponentially grew, and then the problem becomes, wait, it's too many at this time. We have to cut it off at some point.
I see. It's a huge problem.
It is a problem.
We just have about 30 seconds for your question, Anne.
Hi. You mentioned an apprenticeship program that the bar has for people that are trying to become attorneys. Could you, I came in on the tail end, can you say a little bit more specifically about what that is?
It's a program the state bar has for law office study, and actually, you can go online. I believe, Luis, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you can go online and find out the rules and regulations pertaining to law office study.
Yes, you're correct, Alice.
Google online. Law office study, or go on the Cal Bar and look for law office study.
Luis, do you have a suggestion there?
No, that's the perfect. Go on the State Bar of California website and look for, like Al said, the law office practice study.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Or qualifications to be able to take the California bar exam.
Right.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Anne. And in 30 seconds, Luis, you are speaking as an invited speaker before the World Summit of the Nobel Laureates. Wow. Can you just briefly tell me a little bit about that?
So certainly every year, a number of the past Nobel Peace Laureates get together to talk about world issues like education, health, laws, and this year it's going to be in Atlanta, which celebrates the 50th year of Dr. Martin Luther King receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. And I was fortunate enough to be invited to be one of the speakers in the many panels that they're holding.
Oh, that wonderful. Is such good news. Isn't that wonderful, Tony?
Yes. Yeah, great.
Oh, we couldn't have a better representative.
No,
I'm just delighted to hear that.
You. Thank you.
So thank you very much. Well, we have come to the end of our program, and this is Alice O'Sullivan in for Chuck Finney. Production staff this evening, program engineer is Joanne Marr, production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for your legal rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, by the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, by Labor and Employment Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association, California Applicants Attorneys Association, San Mateo County Bar Association, and the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program. I want to thank my guests very much, J. Antonio Nieres.
Thank you, Alice.
And Luis J. Rodriguez. You've been marvelous guests, and it's been very educational for me, and I know for our listeners as well. Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights Public Radio. I'm Alice O'Sullivan in for Chuck Finney. Uh-huh.